grass was overgrown enough to lose a third grader. He could see tires strewn about it, a few crowbars, a variety of rusted engine parts. On the side of the concrete wall, someone had long ago painted the words "Tire Service" in red and blue. The letters were faded now, beaten and stripped by years of sun. Wilde stayed low and moved to the front. The garage bays were closed. Wilde looked at the bottom of the doors. Wind had covered one up, sealing the bottom. The other garage door, though, had a solid crack opening. Someone had not shut it all the way. There were tire tracks in the dirt leading up to it. Wilde had been confused when he'd first seen that the rest stop was closed. He figured that this had been a meeting place, a spot they could come and hash out their kidnapping plan without drawing attention. He figured that maybe he and Rolla would park and wait and follow, and that the car would lead him to crash. This, of course, was better. Wilde lay on his stomach and moved closer to the opening in the garage door. He peered in. Yep, just as he expected. The car. He was here. Wilde moved back to the side of the garage. He peeked around the corner, taking it all in, before he saw something that made him pull up. The old Dunkin' Donuts hut. At first glance, there was nothing remarkable about it. The windows were covered by plywood. A sign was hanging by one nail. It was run down and beat up, and one day, a wrecking ball would end its existence mercifully and effortlessly. There was only one odd thing. The air conditioning unit in the window toward the back. It looked new. Wilde's heart started pounding. He headed back to Rolla. She greeted him with a "what gives" shrug. He signaled for her to follow him. They slid along the back wall. When the Dunkin' Donuts came into view, Wilde pointed to the air conditioner. It took Rolla a second to get it, but then she gave him a thumbs up. Wilde checked the locator app again. They still had 10 minutes. As he put the phone back in his pocket, Rolla again gave him a look, as if to ask, "What was that?" He shook it off. No time. They'd be out in the open. There was no way to avoid that. Rolla had the gun out. Wilde gestured that he'd go first. If someone took a shot at him, Rolla should be at the ready. She reluctantly agreed. Wilde made the sprint, and as he did, he heard a sound that made the blood in his veins hum. Over the sounds of the cars speeding by on the nearby highway, Wilde could make out the air conditioner. It was on. Someone was in that Dunkin' Donuts back room. When he was up against the wall of the hut, he looked over his shoulder toward Rolla. He was tempted to signal for her to wait there, but suppose whoever was inside the Dunkin' Donuts back room, assuming someone was inside and no one had just left the air conditioning unit on, might be armed. She had the gun. He waved her forward. Rolla kept the weapon at her side, pointed down. She was agile and quick, ever the athlete. When she reached him, they both ducked down. Neither moved for a moment, waiting to see whether they were heard or seen. Nothing. Wilde crawled toward the air conditioner. He gestured with his hand for her to stay down. She nodded. He lifted himself up. He could feel the exhaust air blowing out the back of the unit. The window shade was drawn. He couldn't see in. Now what? Time was a-ticking. He came back down to her. "Someone is in that back room," he whispered. "But someone may also be in the gas station office. I need you to draw the gun and be ready. I'm going to open the window a crack and pull out the air conditioner, quietly if I can. You be ready?" Rolla nodded. "Got it." He stood and inspected the window. The unit didn't look screwed in or anything like that. All he had to do was slide the window up an inch and pull the air conditioner out, all in one swift move. Wilde rehearsed the action in his mind as he put his hands on the bottom of the window frame. Rolla stood with her back against the wall. The gun was ready. Then Wilde mouthed the countdown to her. 1. 2. On 3, Wilde pushed the window open and grabbed the air conditioner out. At the same time, Rolla swung into action. She spun toward the opening, the gun up and ready. When Rolla saw who was inside, she pulled the gun to her side. Wilde dropped the air conditioner and looked too. Crash Maynard was chained to a bed. His hand was wrapped in heavy white gauze. Crash looked back toward them, stunned. Wild moved fast. He put his index finger to his lips while slipping through the window. He hurried over to the teen and whispered, "Stay quiet, Crash. We're here to help." Tears started rolling down Crash's face.
"I want to go home."
He sounded like a little boy. "You're going home," Wild whispered. "I promise you." "How many of them are here?" Crash held up the gauze-encased hand.
"Look what they did to me."
"I know. We're going to get you to a doctor. Focus, Crash. How many of them?"
"I don't know. They don't talk. They wear ski masks. Please, please. I just want to get home. Please."
He started sobbing. Wild checked the shackle holding the boy in place. The chain traveled from his ankle to a plate in the wall. He looked back at the window for Rolla. He was surprised not to see her. 2 seconds later, Rolla popped back into view. This time, carrying one of the discarded crowbars, she handed it to him. Crash cried,
"Please!"
"It's okay, Crash. Hold on." Wild used the crowbar against the plate in the wall. It didn't take long. 2 tugs and the plate popped out. At 16 years old, Crash was pretty close to fully grown. Wild would be able to carry him if need be, but the teen rolled quickly off the bed and stood. "Do you know where they stay?" Wild asked. Crash shook his head.
"I want to go home, please."
"How about Naomi?" He was pretty sure he knew the answer, but Crash's baffled expression confirmed it.
"Naomi Pine?"
"Never mind." They moved to the window. Crash climbed through first. Rolla helped him. Wild followed. When they were back outside, they ducked down and stayed as low as possible. "Take him back to the car," Wild told her. "You come with us," Rolla said. "No. I have more work to do."
"You think Naomi might?"
"Just go. Take him." Rolla's eyes bore into his.
"We can just call the police, Wild. They can have 100 cops surrounding this place in 10 minutes.
"No," Wild said again.
"I don't understand."
"No time to explain. Take him. I'll be fine." Rolla studied his face. Wild didn't like that, but he gave her nothing. She frowned and handed him the gun.
"In case you need it."
"Thanks."
"I'm giving you 15 minutes. If I don't hear from you by then, I'm calling the police."
"Don't wait for me. When you get back to the car, take him immediately to the Valley Hospital. The finger is there. Every second counts."
"I don't like this, Wild."
"Trust me, my sister." Rolla's eyes welled up when he called her that. She looked toward Crash.
"Think you can make a run for it?"
Crash had stopped crying now.
"I'm ready."
Rolla took off first. Crash followed her, cradling his injured hand with his good one. Wild watched until they were out of sight. He checked the locator app. There wasn't much time. Chapter 37 Wild moved to the back of the gas station again, then to the wall with the faded tire service on the side. A few seconds later, he crawled in front of the mechanic bay door that had been opened a crack. He got on his stomach, making himself as flat as possible. He needed to hurry. Still on his stomach, he looked through the opening. Wild could see that the door slid up and down on a track with wheels, manual, not electric. That was good. He got up on his knees now, cupped his hands to the bottom of the door, and using a bicep curl movement, he moved it up 1 inch. The door squeaked. Loud enough for someone to hear? That he didn't know. He assumed that no one was in the actual garage, the more likely place for the kidnapper to be. The only place left, really, was in the adjacent gas station office. Wild stayed still, listening for anyone coming. No one. All he heard was the now familiar cacophony of cars speeding by. He hoped that no one from the road would see him. He didn't want someone calling the police to report a strange intruder. Not yet, anyway. He pulled up on the door another inch, then another. Squeak. Squeak. Enough. He forced it up another 6 inches. That was all he'd need. He got back on his belly and shimmied into the garage. It was dark. Dust came up and into his nose, but that wouldn't bother him. The garage reeked of spilled petrol and mildew. Wild got up, stayed low, moved to the side of the car farthest away from the adjacent office. He heard the clack of someone typing on a keyboard. Wilde hadn't lied to Rolla, but he hadn't told her the entire truth either. He hadn't told her that he'd figured out about this rest stop in the simplest way possible. From the GPS locators Rolla herself had given him, he hadn't told her that the car he'd spotted in this garage bay, the car he was now hiding behind, was the same Chevrolet Cruze that Gavin Chambers had used to meet him at that 7-Eleven. That had been a mistake on Gavin's part. Wilde's suspicions, which had already taken root, blossomed the moment Gavin pulled into that 7-Eleven without his usual driver or SUV vehicle. Why suddenly come alone? Why would a guy with his money, a guy who normally got chauffeured around in a Cadillac Escalade, now be driving a Chevrolet Cruze, a car model used extensively by rental car companies? On its own, that meant nothing. But it was enough. Still ducking behind the Chevy, still hearing the clacking of someone typing, Wilde checked the locator app on his phone. 2 minutes until the other car arrived. He had to get ready. Wilde crawled from the back tire to the front one, and then to the front bumper. He looked to his left toward the door to the office. It was open. He could see a man's back, but he'd need to get closer to make sure. He moved a little farther out toward the shelving. He stayed low. When he was about 2 feet from the back wall, he could make out the profile of the man who was typing. Gavin Chambers. Without warning, Gavin turned his head toward Wilde. Wilde dropped flat on his stomach again. The gun was tucked into his waistband in the back. He reached now and took it out. Gavin, no doubt, would be armed. If Gavin had spotted him, if he was right now on his way. But no, the other car had arrived. On its way past the locked gate, it had tripped a sensor. That was what had alerted Gavin. That was why he turned his head. Wilde crawled back so that he was hidden between the Chevrolet Cruze and the far wall. A minute later, he heard the fumbling of the other bay door. Gavin Chambers rose from his chair. From under the carriage of the Chevy, Wilde could see Gavin's feet go past. Gavin pulled the bay door all the way open. A car pulled in. Gavin immediately shut the door behind it. The driver opened the door and stepped out. "Did Maynard send the tape? Did you watch it yet?" It was Saul Strauss. Gavin said, "I'm just watching it now." "And?" "And it's solid gold," Gavin said. "Rusty admits he killed Anson, though he claims it was in self-defense." "My God, yes." "We need to send it out now. Take no chances." "Agree," Gavin said. The two men headed into the office. Wilde stayed where he was. "I knew it," Strauss said, a lilt in his voice. "I knew that tape existed. I didn't want it to go this far, but..." "I could see why Dash was reticent about giving it up," Chambers said. "It ruins Rusty, sure, but it hurts him too. I don't know if Maynard can be charged for helping move the body. That statute of limitations is probably passed, but anyone who hears it will know what he did."
"And he let Raymond Stark take the fall."
"I know.
It's one thing to help out a buddy, I guess, but to sit back while another man goes to prison for life."
"Scum," Gavin agreed. "Let's get the tape ready."
Wilde didn't move. He could, of course, stop them now. He could rise up and point the gun and not let them get back to the computer. But he didn't. Wilde waited.
"I got it keyed up," Gavin said.
"All the major networks?" Strauss asked.
"Plus some bloggers and Twitter accounts."
"This is it, my friend. Hit send."
One last chance for Wilde to act. He heard the click of the key.
"Done," Gavin said.
The relief in his tone was palpable.
"We need to free the kid," Strauss said. "You have the coordinates to send to the Maynards?"
"Do you think we should wait?" Gavin asked.
"Why?"
"I don't know. They may have more."
"More?"
"More tapes," Gavin Chambers said.
"They could be holding out on us."
"We can't," Strauss said. It's gone far enough, Gavin. That boy."
"Yeah."
Wilde could hear the devastation now in Gavin's voice.
Yeah, you're right. Hand me the ski mask. Let's go finish this.
Wild came out from his hiding spot and pointed the gun at them.
No need.
Gavin Chambers and Saul Strauss spun toward him. Wild raised the gun.
If you breathe wrong, Wild said, I'll shoot you both.
Gavin, I assume you're armed?
I am.
Holster under the left armpit?
Yes.
You know the drill. Thumb and index finger. Throw it over here.
Do it slowly.
Saul?
I'm unarmed.
Saul held up his hands and twirled slowly. Keep your hands on the desk where I can see them. Gavin, toss the gun. Gavin Chambers took the gun out of his holster and tossed it on the floor toward Wild. Wild picked it up and stuck it in his waistband.
How did you figure it out? Gavin asked.
Lots of things. But the main one was the most basic. I kept wondering how Crash could be kidnapped so close to his own home, with someone as good as you guarding him. The simplest answer. He can't.
So you had to be involved.
Wild looked at Gavin, then at Saul.
I assume you guys hatched this idea after Naomi Pine ran away.
We did, Gavin said.
Made sense. Naomi goes missing. She has a tentative connection to Crash.
So you know that if Crash goes missing now, everyone will tie them together. It gave you time. It gave you the ultimate diversion.
You even said it to me, Gavin.
Said what?
At my eco-capsule.
The Ghost Army. Everything you did was about tactical deception.
And yet, here we are.
Here we are.
Gavin smiled.
We overdid it, didn't we?
You did.
I didn't expect the Maynards to bring you and Hester in.
Right. That threw you. That's why you kept insisting I concentrate on Naomi.
You knew that even if I was successful in finding her, I'd be no closer to the truth about Crash.
The problem is, you both gilded that lily.
Saul, you show up at the hotel bar to ask me about Naomi the night Crash disappears. Why?
I didn't realize it at the time, but even if you thought Crash and Naomi were close,
why would you ask me to help you?
You were just planting the seed, so I'd go in the wrong direction.
Then you, Wild, looked back at Gavin. You show up at the 7-Eleven with some suddenly unearthed secret message that again was supposed to make me think that Naomi was connected to whatever happened to Crash.
Gavin nodded, seeing it now.
You asked me for a ride to the Maynards.
Right.
That's when you planted the GPS tracker in the car.
You're a wealthy, successful man. You always have a driver, or at least an expensive car. Suddenly you're in a Chevy Cruze.
I figured it was a rental.
But you didn't know for sure.
I was just covering my bases.
Then today, Saul conveniently shows up by the school. He claims to have men following me, that he has an inside source at the Maynards.
But who would that be?
Hester wouldn't talk. Neither would my people. The Maynards? Not a chance.
So it had to be the kidnapper.
You, Gavin.
Eliminate the possible, and whatever remains, Saul said, quoting Arthur Conan Doyle. No matter how improbable is the truth.
Exactly.
So when Saul drove me up to Sing Sing, I planted another GPS locator in his car. After you dropped me back near the Maynards, you drove up to this rest stop. You didn't stay long, just to feed the kid, I guess. Look in on him. But the day before, according to the locator in Gavin's Cruze, he had stopped here too. Why would both of you be in this fairly remote rest stop?
You two had to be in on this together.
Oh, and the finger coordinates, being where I was found as a kid, again, overkill. The only reason someone would do that would be to mess with my head. Of course, I got stuff wrong too, like, I figured you just rendezvoused at this rest stop. Met up, discussed things, whatever. But when I arrived just now, I was surprised to see it was closed.
How did you sneak in here, anyway? We have sensors by all the entrances,
but not in the back. There's a Dairy Queen.
So you found Crash in the Dunkin' Donuts hut?
Yes.
Where is he now?
Probably at the hospital. Rolla took him.
So, Rolla knows about this?
Wild chose not to reply.
You get why we did this, Saul said. You see the danger, right?
It took me a while to remove the blinders of self-interest, Gavin said.
You become so enmeshed in a charismatic leader, seduced by all that he can give you, that you can't see past his bullshit. Then Saul started pleading his case to me.
You didn't need much persuasion, Saul said. You were already starting to see.
Maybe I was. The pill-popping, the erratic behavior, the ease with which he could manipulate. I liked his idea of tearing down the social order to rebuild, but as I spent more time with him, it became clear that Rusty doesn't want to rebuild. Rusty wants to destroy this country. He wants to pull us apart by the seams.
We two old men don't agree on much, Saul said. I'm on one side of the political aisle, Gavin is on the other. But we are both Americans. Our views, opposite as they might seem, are in the realm of normalcy.
That's not what Rusty wants. Rusty wants to make everyone choose a side, turn everyone into an extremist.
Seems it worked, Wilde said, still holding the gun on them.
What do you mean?
You two kidnapped a child. You cut off his finger. If that's not being an extremist.
Their faces fell, both of them.
Gavin said, you think we wanted to do that?
It doesn't matter what you wanted.
You tell me, Sol Strauss said. Would Dash Maynard have given up the tape any other way?
Again, doesn't matter. You made the choice.
Wilde said it slowly and with emphasis. You cut off a boy's finger.
Gavin Chambers lowered his head.
Saul Strauss tried to hold his high, but his mouth was quaking.
Crash was drugged up when we did that, unconscious, Saul said. We kept the pain and trauma to a minimum.
You disfigured him.
Then you threatened to cut off his arm.
Suppose the Maynards didn't send the tape.
Would you have gone through with that? Would you have sent them his arm?
Gavin Chambers finally looked up.
How far would you go to save millions of lives, Wilde?
This isn't about me. We're all soldiers here, so it damn well is, Gavin said.
This battlefield might not be as obvious, but lives are at stake. Millions. So if disfiguring or killing one person, even an innocent kid, could save millions of lives, would you do it?
That's a pretty slippery slope you're standing on, Colonel.
The frontline troops are always standing on a slippery slope. You know that. Would we have rather cut off our own fingers to save those lives? Of course. But that wasn't the choice. Life isn't lived in the black and white Wild. People like to think so nowadays. All the online outrage, things are either all good or all bad. But life is lived in the gray. Life is lived in the nuances.
Even now, Saul added, you standing there holding a gun on us. Gavin and I are willing to pay the price for what we did. We felt we had no choice. But we've now saved Raymond.
Righting a tremendous wrong, Gavin added. Nothing hypothetical about that.
And on a much larger scale, we maybe saved this country. That tape we just sent out could change the course of history.
The two men waited now for Wilde to say something. After a few moments passed, Gavin put his hand on Saul Strauss's arm.
Oh, man.
What?
Saul said.
Wilde gets it.
Strauss frowned. What do you mean?
Gavin met Wilde's eye.
I mean, Wilde has been hiding in this garage since before you arrived.
So?
So he waited, Saul. He waited for you to get here. He waited until we sent out the tape.
Silence. Strauss saw it now. He turned to face Wilde, too.
You could have stopped us. You could have popped out with that gun 2 minutes earlier.
And the tape would never have seen the light of day, Gavin added.
But you didn't do that, Wilde.
Both men were nodding along now.
You came out with us on that slippery slope.
Wilde said nothing.
In the end, Gavin said, we're just three soldiers.
One last mission,
You let us complete it. In my case, Gavin said, taking a step in front of Saul, a suicide mission.
Wilde finally spoke.
Wait, what?
I'll be okay in prison, Saul said. I'll still be able to speak out. I can still be a voice.
But I'm an old man, and I don't want to face that, Gavin said.
He stood and reached out his hand.
Let me have my gun back, Wilde. Warrior to warrior. Let me end this on my own terms.
Suicide.
No, Wilde said. Then I'll run at you. I'll force you to shoot me.
That's not going to happen either, Wilde said. Listen closely. You had your mission. I had mine. Mine was to find two missing kids. I rescued one. I then stayed behind to search these premises for the other. That's what I'll tell Rolla. Naomi isn't here, is she?
No, Saul said, confused. We don't know anything about that.
Then my mission here is complete.
I don't understand, Saul said.
Yeah, Wilde said. I think you do. Wilde didn't say another word. He just lowered the gun and walked away.
Part 3. Chapter 38. 3 weeks later. Hester was finishing up a meeting with Simon Green, the rich financial advisor who was captured on a viral video punching what looked like a vagrant in Central Park. She liked Green, felt that he was getting a bad rap, but more important, the call from the Manhattan DA indicated that they wouldn't be pressing charges, in part because no one could locate the supposed victim. Hester walked Green to her office door. Simon Green thanked her. Hester gave him a bus on the cheek. That was when she saw her seated in the waiting room. Hester stormed over to her executive assistant, Sarah McClin, and said, "Why is Delia Maynard here?" She asked for 15 minutes. She said it was important.
"You should tell me these things."
"I did."
"When?"
"Did you check your texts?"
"A text isn't telling me."
"How many times have we gone over this? You told me not to interrupt you and to inform you of schedule changes via text."
"I did?"
"You did. Now you have 15 minutes before your next client gets here. It's a billable 15 minutes, and Delia Maynard is a client. Should I tell her to go home or
stop already?"
"You're a bigger nag than I am. Send her in." Hester had not seen Delia Maynard since that awful day at the manor 3 weeks ago, right before the finger was found. Sarah showed Delia into the office and closed the door behind her. The two women stood and stared at one another for a long moment.
"How's your son?" Hester asked.
"Better," Delia said. "They were able to attach the finger."
"Oh, good.
Physically, he's doing fine. And mentally?" "There are nightmares. It seems the kidnappers, whoever they were, treated him well, but I understand. And you've decided not to involve the police."
"That's right."
"No one asked you how his finger got severed?"
"The doctor did, of course. We said it was a fishing incident."
"I don't think she bought it, especially since it was hours between the time the finger arrived at the hospital and the time Crash got there, but there's nothing that can be proved."
"So, no one else knows about the kidnapping?"
"No one." Delia had no idea Gavin Chambers and Saul Strauss had kidnapped her son. Hester knew, of course. 3 weeks ago, Wilde had confided in her, and her only. She didn't like what Wilde had done in the end. You don't work outside of the system. The system may be flawed, but you don't cut off children's fingers even to save a wrongly convicted man, or even to save, such dramatics, the world. She hadn't seen Wilde in 3 weeks, either.
"So why are you here, Delia?"
"To say goodbye."
"Oh?"
"We are taking the family and moving overseas for a while."
"I see.
Since that tape became public, you can't imagine what it's been like."
"I think I can.
There are constant death threats coming from Rusty supporters. They think Dash made it up or doctored it to destroy their hero."
"Fake news,"
Hester said. "Yes. As our attorney, you know that Dash can't comment or authenticate it." Hester swallowed hard.
"Right. It would be self-incrimination."
Dash Maynard had committed felonies that night by moving the dead body. Hester had wanted to work Raymond Stark's case pro bono, but unfortunately she couldn't because of the conflict of interest in her representing the Maynards. Her hands were also tied. She wanted Dash more than anything to come forward, but as his attorney, she had to advise him against it. The system was flawed, but it was still the system. She didn't think Dash would come forward anyway. She also didn't think it would help. That was the worst part of it all. At first, the release of the tape seemed to destroy Rusty Eggers once and for all. At first. But mythical beasts don't die, do they? When you try to kill them, they come back stronger. So, the tape was a fake. If it wasn't an outright fake, it was doctored. If it wasn't doctored, it all happened 30 years ago, so it didn't matter. If it mattered, Rusty Eggers said on the tape that he killed the man in self-defense, and that's not a crime. If it's a crime, it was 30 years ago, when Rusty Eggers was just a young student, and, well, someone tried to kill him, so he had no choice but to defend himself. And if the death was later blamed on an innocent black man, that was the police's fault, not Rusty Eggers. Blame that crooked cop, Kindler. Blame the racist system. And if it's not racism, Raymond Stark had a criminal record, even as a 17-year-old, so he probably would have ended up in prison on another charge. Maybe Stark did other crimes that night, who knows? Maybe Raymond Stark was involved in Christopher Anson's killing anyway. If it was self-defense, maybe Raymond Stark joined forces with Christopher Anson to attack Rusty Eggers. Maybe Raymond Stark and Christopher Anson together tried to rob Rusty Eggers and Raymond Stark ran off with the knife. Maybe that was why the knife was on him. Like that. Most of the media scoffed at these theories, which just made the Eggers supporters, coming from both the far right and the far left, dig in their heels and back their man even more. "You said that you would never tell," Delia said. "Sorry?" "No matter what. Even if it was to stop Hitler. If something was told to you under attorney-client privilege, you'd never tell." "That's right." Hester didn't like the way this was headed. "You also told me that there was nothing on those tapes." "I didn't know about that tape," Delia said. "I had no idea that tape existed. I had no idea Dash helped Rusty dump the body in an alley." "Okay. Because I was gone by then." Hester felt an icy hand touch down on her spine. "Sorry." "The two of them fought a lot, Rusty and Christopher. A lot of it was over me, 30 years ago. You know how it was. Girls were things, shiny objects. So I guess they had a big fight in the bar that night. I was dating Rusty then. We were getting serious. Rusty had gotten a plum assignment from the senator. Christopher had been overlooked. I don't know. Who cares anymore? So Christopher knocked on the door. I let him in. He was drunk. He tried to kiss me. I told him no, he didn't stop. No girl was going to say no to Christopher Anson, especially not his rival's girlfriend. You can guess what happened next. I hate the term date rape or acquaintance rape. 30 years ago, it was pathetically considered boys being boys. When I shouted for him to stop, he punched me in the mouth. I ran into the kitchen. He raped me, right there on the floor. He was about to rape me again. Tell you the truth, I don't even remember reaching into the drawer or picking up the knife. Hester just stood there. "You killed him?" Delia moved over to the window. "I sat on the kitchen floor next to him. The knife was still in his chest. I don't think he was dead yet, but I couldn't move. He made gurgling noises for a while. Then those stopped. But I just sat there. I don't know how much time passed. That's how Rusty found me, on the kitchen floor, next to the body. Rusty took over. He cleaned me up. He dressed me. He drove me to Union Station. There was a late Amtrak from Washington to Philadelphia. He got me on it and
told me not to come back until he called. I stayed in a Marriott hotel room for 3 days, ate room service. Rusty told me he moved the body so nobody would know. When I came back to Washington, nothing was the same between us. You can imagine, right? Hester could feel her heart pound against her ribcage. We broke up, and I started dating Dash. Had that been, Hester wondered, an arrangement between the two men? Was Delia just a thing, a shiny object, being bartered for a favor? Or had Rusty really loved her? Had Rusty loved her so much that the politician so many believed would destroy the country, sacrificed his own happiness to protect her? Or does it go deeper than that? Did Rusty's actions that night, getting rid of a bloody corpse, living with the awful lies and aftermath, losing the love of his life and then his parents, are those what warped Rusty Eggers? Had all of that nudged the young college student off the straight and narrow and veered him into becoming the irredeemably damaged man he was now? Delia put up her hands. Her smile was sad. The rest is history. After all that, you're staying with him? Dash? We have a life together. A family, kids, especially a boy who suffered a great trauma and is going to need stability. We both kept secrets from each other. I, at least, know his now. And you won't tell him yours? That I was the one who killed Christopher? Delia shook her head. No, never. Hell of a thing to live with, Hester said. Been living with it for over 30 years, Delia said. She made a production out of checking her watch. I better go. People wouldn't blame you, Hester said, trying to keep the desperation out of her voice. You were being raped. You can still come out of this doing the right thing. I am doing the right thing. For me. For my family. She turned to leave. There was one secret you and Dash both kept, Hester said. What's that? What did you think when you heard that Raymond Stark had been arrested for Christopher's murder? Delia didn't reply. You both knew the truth, right, you and Dash? You didn't talk about it with each other? But you both knew that an innocent man had been arrested. You never came forward. And say what? Delia asked. That you did it in self-defense. You think anyone would believe me? So you just let Raymond Stark take the fall? I hoped he'd get off. And when he didn't? Hester crossed the room and got into her face. When he got sentenced to life in prison for something he didn't do, when he got beaten and abused, I didn't sentence him. I didn't beat him or abuse him. Won't the tape free him now? No, Delia. The tape won't be enough. Raymond Stark will stay in prison. Hester took a breath, tried to sound reasonable. But please, listen to me. No. I'm leaving now. You helped lock him up. You can't just... Goodbye, Hester. I could tell. Delia smiled and shook her head. No, you couldn't, Hester. Hester stood there, her fists at her side, her body shaking. First off, Delia said, there's no evidence. I'll just deny it. But more than that, you won't violate attorney-client privilege. Even if it meant saving the world from Hitler. Even if it means an innocent man stays in jail. The system was flawed, but it was still the system. Delia Maynard left the office then. For a few minutes, Hester didn't move. Sarah McClinn came in and said, your next appointment, cancel. Oh, I can't just cancel. He's cancel. The tone left no room for argument. Hester circled back to her desk. With a shaking hand, she picked up the phone and dialed the number. The voice that answered sounded tentative. Hello? Oren? She hadn't spoken to him in 3 weeks, not since the pizza date. She hadn't returned his calls or answered his texts.
Are you okay, Hester?
I need you to take me someplace. I need you to take me now.
Chapter 39. 2 hours later, Orin pulled the squad car onto the shoulder of Mountain Road. He turned off the ignition. For a few moments, the two of them just sat in silence.
Are you sure you want to do this?
When Hester nodded, Orin got out of the passenger side and opened her door. Up ahead, Hester saw the weathered, makeshift cross. It was odd for her to see it here. Her son had been raised somewhere between agnostic and Jewish, but for some reason, Hester didn't mind it. Someone had cared. Someone had tried. Hester walked over to the edge of the highway and looked down the steep embankment.
So, this is where...
Yes. Hester had never had the courage, if courage was the right word, to come here. Ira had, many times. He wouldn't tell her. He would say he was going out for a ride or to pick up milk at the 7-Eleven. But she knew that he would pull his car over on the shoulder, maybe in this exact same spot, and get out and look at the makeshift cross and sob. Ira hadn't told her. She wished that he had.
Where did the car end up?
Down there, Orin said, pointing to a spot far down the hill.
You were one of the first officers on the scene.
Orin couldn't tell whether that was a question or a statement.
Yes.
The car was on fire.
Yes. Wild had already pulled David out. Orin just nodded this time.
Wild told me he was the one driving, Hester said.
He told us that too, Orin said. We didn't charge him, though. No alcohol in his system. The roads were wet.
Was Wild driving?
That's what our report said.
Hester turned to him. I'm not asking you what your report said.
Orin's eyes stayed on the ravine. When the only survivor of a car accident tells you he was the driver, it's hard to prove otherwise.
Wild lied, didn't he?
Orin didn't reply. Hester stood so that they were shoulder to shoulder.
Wild and David were best friends. You know that, right?
Orin nodded, I do.
That night, they went to Miller's Tavern in David's car. My David didn't drink much or go for bars much. That was more Wild scene, I think. That he was having problems with Layla. Nothing serious, nothing they wouldn't get past. So the two best friends went out to blow off some steam, or whatever men do. David drank too much. The hospital ran a toxicology report when he was rushed in, when they still thought my boy would survive. Wild didn't want to get David in trouble, so he said it was him, that he was driving.
Orin still said nothing.
Is that what happened, Orin?
Did you ask Wild?
He insists he was driving.
But you don't believe him.
I don't, no. Am I right?
Orin looked down. She watched his eyes. They were so clear, so honest, so beautiful.
Orin?
Then he said something that surprised her. I don't think you have it exactly right.
For a moment, she couldn't find her voice. When she did, what do you mean?
Wild would never have let David drive drunk.
So,
Hester didn't know what to say.
I'm not following.
We checked Miller's Tavern. Wild was a regular, as you said. David wasn't. But that night, yeah, he got pretty drunk. Anyway, nothing we could prove, but one patron said Wild left at least half an hour before David, on his own.
Why?
I don't know. Wild would only tell us he was the driver.
David was there alone?
Alone, and drinking, yes. This was all just a theory, Hester. But at that time, Wild was living in a tent not far from here. He pointed to the left.
Maybe 300 yards in that direction. Again, I don't have any proof. Wilde insisted that he drove, but yeah, I never believed it. I think Wilde was nearby. I think he heard the crash or saw the flames. I think he wanted to protect his friend. And I think he feels guilty about not staying at the bar that night. Hester felt a thud deep in her chest.
So, you think David was alone in the car?
When Orin nodded, Hester dropped to her knees. She dropped to her knees and cried. Orin let her. He stood there, close enough that if she needed him, he was there. But he didn't reach out to her. Thank God. Thank God this man, this good and decent man, knew not to hug her or offer words of false comfort. He just let her cry. It took some time. She couldn't say how much, 5 minutes, 10, maybe half an hour. Orin Carmichael just stood there, guarding her like a silent sentinel. At some point, she got back into his squad car. He started down Mountain Road. They drove in silence. Finally,
Orin,
I'm here.
I'm sorry I didn't call you back.
Orin didn't reply.
When you rushed out of the pizzeria to go to that car accident, I realized that we had no chance because no matter what, whenever I see you, I will imagine you at the scene of that accident. Whenever I see you, I will see my dead son. You'll always remind me of David, so we can't be.
He kept his eyes on the road.
But then I started missing you so damn much. It was like there was a giant hole in my heart. I know how that sounds. I started thinking that even with that pain, I didn't want to be without you. I didn't want to stop thinking about my David. Not ever. Because that would be the worst outrage. I'll never stop thinking about him. You understand?
Orin nodded. I do. She reached out and put her hand on his.
Are you willing to give us another chance, Orin?
Yeah, he said. Yeah. I'd really like that. Chapter 40 Wilde bought a round-trip ticket for the Delta shuttle flight from New York's LaGuardia Airport to Boston's Logan. He had no luggage. He didn't plan on staying in Boston long, a few hours tops. Then he'd fly back home. In fact, he planned to never leave the airport. When the plane landed, Wilde walked over from Terminal A to E. He positioned himself near Gate E7, where he would eventually watch passengers board American Airlines Flight 374 to Costa Rica. 2 hours to go. To pass the time, Wilde opened the DNA genealogy website and found the message from PB. He read it again, thought about it, then decided to write. I'd like to know more, PB. Can we meet? He was about to put away his phone when it rang. Wilde checked the caller ID and saw that it was Matthew. He picked up immediately. Everything okay? Wilde said.
You don't have to answer the phone like that, Matthew said. You can just say hello.
Hello. Everything okay?
Yeah, Wilde. Except I haven't seen you in weeks.
Sorry.
How are things at school? Calming down? Crash is back already. He keeps showing off this scar on his finger and saying some bad guys cut it off. Mom says it was a fishing accident. Wilde?
Yeah.
Everyone thinks Naomi ran away. They think she's somewhere on an island or doing something cool or exotic. Which is ironic, since they always thought she was such a loser.
I know.
Are you still looking for her?
Wilde did not answer that, so he kept it simple.
Yes. Cool.
Then,
where are you? I hear a lot of noise.
In Boston.
Why?
Visiting a friend.
Matthew must have heard something in his tone. Okay.
How's Mom? Wilde asked.
Still with Daryl.
Daryl?
Designer Threads had a name now.
Daryl.
They're getting serious, I think, Matthew said. Wilde closed his eyes for a moment.
You like him?
He's okay, Matthew said, which in Matthew speak was a rave.
Good.
Be nice to him.
Ah,
your mom deserves this.
Fine.
Whatever. The flight to Costa Rica was ready to board now. The gate agent called for passengers needing special assistance, passengers traveling with children under the age of 2, active-duty U.S. military members. Anything else? Wilde asked him.
Nope, all good.
Call me if you need anything.
Anything?
Yes.
There's a new Grand Theft Auto, but Mom won't buy it for me because it's too violent.
Funny. Bye, Wilde. Talk soon. He hung up as the gate agent called for Group 1 to board. Wilde watched the passengers start to mingle near the boarding line. Nothing. The gate agent called for groups 2, 3, and 4. Still nothing. For a moment, Wilde wondered whether he had gotten it wrong or perhaps someone was again trying tactical deception with him. Perhaps they had booked more than one flight to throw him. Perhaps they never intended to fly today. But when the gate agent called the final group, Wilde spotted a young girl getting into the line wearing, yep, a baseball cap and sunglasses. Naomi Pine. Standing in front of her, holding both their tickets, was Ava O'Brien. For a few seconds, Wilde didn't move. He didn't have to do anything. He didn't have to approach them. He could, like with Gavin Chambers and Saul Strauss, simply melt away. But he didn't. Enough stalling. Wilde walked over and tapped Naomi on the shoulder. Naomi jumped, startled. When she turned and saw his face, her hand flew to her mouth.
Oh, my God! Wilde?
Ava spun now, too. For a few seconds, they all just stood there. Ava said,
How did you...
Do you remember when you were leaving 7-Eleven and I told you to roll down your window?
What?
Ava looked baffled.
What about it?
I leaned in and put a GPS tracker in your car. It was the same deal as with Gavin and Strauss. Ava, too, had overdone it with the tactical diversions. When he told her about Crash disappearing, all of a sudden Ava had remembered that Naomi had mentioned a possible romance with Crash, strongly hinting that the two teens had run off together. Ava had been trying to throw him off the scent, too. The question was, why? She clearly had nothing to do with Crash Maynard. You're from Maine, Wilde said.
Yes, I told you that.
Why would you move to New Jersey to take a job you were overqualified for? Ava shrugged.
I wanted a change.
No, Wilde said. You've also been back to Maine 4 times in the past 3 weeks.
I have family up there.
Again, no. You stayed at the Howard Johnsons in South Portland, where you had Naomi hiding. But more than that, you visited the Hope Faith Adoption Agency in Wyndham 2 times. Ava closed her eyes. You didn't take the assistant teaching job because you wanted to live in New Jersey, Wilde said. You did it to be closer to the daughter you had to give up for adoption. For a moment, it looked as though Ava might deny it, but only for a moment.
You have to understand, Ava said. I never wanted to give Naomi up.
So there it was. I was only 17. I didn't know any better. But I just had, I don't know, it was a feeling or a want or a premonition or... So I went back to the agency. I begged them to tell me what happened to my daughter. They wouldn't, not at first. So I paid someone off. They gave me Naomi's new name and address, but they explained that I had no rights. That was okay. I just wanted to see her, you know. So I just figured you'd take the teaching job to be close to her.
Right. What harm would it do?
Wilde? It was Naomi.
Don't make me go back.
I just wanted to see how she was, Ava said. That's all. I didn't want to mess up her life. But then I saw the hell she was living through, day after day,
I had to sit back and watch my child being bullied with no support from home.
So you became her friend, Wilde said. Her confidant.
Is that so wrong?
Wilde turned to Naomi. When did Ava tell you the truth?
That she was my real mother?
Yes.
After I came back from the challenge,
Naomi said.
At first, I thought she was making it up, or like it was a dream come true, you know? Do you remember our talk in my basement? How I wanted to change everything?
Wilde nodded.
It wasn't just at school. It was everything. My father.
Her voice just faded out. Bernard Pine would not come out of this unscathed either. Rolla was working up a way to make him pay for what he'd done. So you two decided to run away, Wilde said.
I didn't want that, Ava said. I wanted to do it legally.
Which is why you went to Layla.
Yes. I told her how awful Naomi's adoptive parents were, but I still had no rights. Layla said it would take months or years to prove neglect or abuse, and even then winning was unlikely.
So that's when you hatched this plan, Wilde said.
You'd run away and hide. You, he looked at Ava, you'd get Naomi a fake ID while finishing out the school year. If you left your teaching post right away, that would draw suspicion. So you two waited, and now it's time to flee the country together.
Ava just looked at him with her big brown eyes.
The boarding line was clear. The gate agent made another announcement. Naomi stepped forward and put her hand on his arm.
Please, Wilde. If we're caught, I'll have to go back to him. Ava might go to jail.
She's my daughter, Ava said, her tone never steadier. I love her with all my heart.
They both stood together and faced him.
I know, Wilde said. So?
I just came to make sure you were all right, Wilde said, and to say goodbye. Naomi threw her arms around him so hard, she almost knocked him over. Wilde usually recoiled from this sort of embrace, but he didn't, not this time. He let the girl hold him, and it felt right.
Thank you, Naomi whispered.
Wilde nodded. If you ever need anything. The boarding agent was back on the loudspeaker.
Final call for flight 374 with service to Liberia, Costa Rica.
You guys better get on board, Wilde said.
Naomi looked at Ava. Ava looked back. Then Ava turned and took Wilde's hand. It said something that caught him totally off guard. Come with us, Wilde.
What?
Naomi put her hands together.
Please?
Wilde shook his head. I can't. Ava held on to his hand and said it again.
Come with us, Wilde.
No, he said.
Why not? Ava asked.
It's crazy, Wilde said.
So?
Ava gave him a smile that dazzled and stunned. Everything about this is crazy. Wilde shook his head again, even as he felt something in his chest crack open.
You guys need to get on board.
Come with us, Wilde, Ava said again.
Naomi needs you.
Maybe I need you too.
I don't know. If it doesn't work out, you just come back.
I can't, Wilde said. The gate agent came over, cleared her throat, and said,
I'm closing the door in 30 seconds.
They're boarding now, Wilde said in a tone that left no room for debate. Naomi's eyes were wet with tears when she threw her arms around him one more time. Then Ava handed the gate agent their tickets to scan. Wilde watched them start down the jet bridge. Naomi turned and waved. Wilde waved back. Ava's eyes lingered on his a little longer. When she broke eye contact and turned away, Wilde felt his chest crack open a little more. He watched them disappear from view. The gate agent reached for the door. As she was about to close it, Wilde asked,
Is there any room on this flight?
What?
Want to buy a ticket?
Yes. The gate agent squinted at her computer screen.
Well, what do you know? She said. There's one more ticket available.
Thank you. We hope you have enjoyed our presentation of The Boy from the Woods by Harlan Coben, performed by Stephen Weber. Performance copyright 2020 by Brilliance Publishing, Inc. All rights reserved. For further information concerning this program or other Brilliance audio titles, please visit our website at www.brilliancepublishing.com. No part of this recording may be played for an audience or reproduced in any form. It may not be streamed, downloaded, broadcast, or copied without written permission. Address all inquiries to Brilliance Audio, P.O. Box 887, Grand Haven, Michigan, 49417.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.